Epilogue. The unifying theme of this book is the concept of reflexivity. I have focused on its implications for the social sciences in general and financial markets in particular. I have left other areas largely unexplored. I should like to mention them briefly here, although my thoughts relating to them are not properly developed. They ought to form the subject of another book in the future, but I'm afraid I may not have a chance to write it, especially if I remain involved in financial markets. First, the question of values. Economic theory has trained us to take values as given, although the evidence suggests that they are shaped by a reflexive process. Most values can be reduced to economic terms nowadays. The most recent Nobel laureate in economics earned his prize by interpreting politics as an economic process in which the participants seek to maximize their own benefits. But that has not always been the case, and even today there are many parts of the world where profit-maximizing behavior takes second place to other motivations. Religion and tradition are less easily amenable to economic analysis than is politics in a materialistic culture. We have great difficulty in understanding a phenomenon like Islamic fundamentalism. At the other end of the scale, a movement that we profess to admire, solidarity, is also alien to our way of thinking. The predominance of economic values in Western and Westernized societies is itself a function of our economic success. Values evolve in reflexive fashion. The fact that economic activity has borne positive results has enhanced the value we put on economic values. The same can be said about scientific method. The triumphs of natural science have raised the status of scientific method to unsustainable heights. Conversely, various forms of art have played a much bigger role in cultures not very far removed from our own, just because it was easier to achieve positive results in art than in economic activity. Reflexive processes are bound to lead to excesses, but it is impossible to define what is excessive because in matters of values there is no such thing as normal. Perhaps the best way to approach the subject of values is to start from the position that they are rooted in fantasy rather than reality. As a consequence, every set of values has a flaw in it. We can then ask what are the elements of fantasy in a particular set of values and how the elements of fantasy and reality have interacted. Any other approach would introduce a bias in favor of our own flawed set of values. Values are closely associated with the concept of self, a reflexive concept if ever there was one. What we think has a much greater bearing on what we are than on the world around us. What we are cannot possibly correspond to what we think we are, but there is a two-way interplay between the two concepts. As we make our way in the world, our sense of self evolves. The relationship between what we think we are and what we are in reality is the key to happiness. In other words, it provides the subjective meaning of life. I could readily provide a reflexive interpretation of my own development, but I am reluctant to do so because it would be too revealing, not to say incriminating. It will come as no surprise to the reader when I admit that I have always harbored an exaggerated view of my self-importance. To put it bluntly, I fancied myself as some kind of god or an economic reformer like Keynes, each with his general theory, or even better, a scientist like Einstein. Reflexivity sounds like relativity. My sense of reality was strong enough to make me realize that these expectations were excessive, and I kept them hidden as a secret guilt. This was a source of considerable unhappiness through much of my adult life. As I made my way in the world, reality came close enough to my fantasy to allow me to admit my secret, at least to myself. Needless to say, I feel much happier as a result. I have been fortunate enough to be able to act out some of my fantasies. This book, in particular, fills me with a great sense of accomplishment. Reality falls far short of my expectations, as the reader can readily observe, but I no longer need to harbor a sense of guilt. Writing this book, and especially these lines, exposes me in a way I never dared to expose myself before, but I feel I can afford it. My success in business protects me. I am free to explore my abilities to their limits, exactly because I do not know where those limits are. Criticism will help me in this endeavor. The only thing that could hurt me is if my success encouraged me to return to my childhood fantasies of omnipotence. But that is not likely to happen as long as I remain engaged in the financial markets, because they constantly remind me of my limitations. Given my personality, I have been extremely lucky in my career choice, but of course it was not really a choice, but a reflexive process in the course of which both my career and my sense of self evolved in tandem. I could say a lot more on the subject, but as long as I have a career in business, I have to plead the Fifth Amendment. There is a point beyond which self-revelation can be damaging, and one of the flaws in my character, which I have not fully fathomed, is the urge to reveal myself. Perhaps I was exaggerating a minute ago when I said I am not afraid of exposing myself. I also have some views on what could be called the meaning of life in the objective sense, if it were not a contradiction in terms to use the word objective in this context. I start from the position that every human endeavor is flawed. If we were to discard everything that is flawed, there would be nothing left. We must therefore make the most of what we have. The alternative is to embrace death. The choice is a real one, because death can be embraced in a number of ways. The pursuit of perfection and eternity in all its manifestations is equivalent to choosing the idea of death over the idea of life. If we carry this line of argument to its logical conclusion, the meaning of life consists of the flaws in one's conceptions and what one does about them. Life can be seen as a fertile fallacy. So far, I have spoken mainly in terms of the individual. But the individual does not exist in isolation. His inherently imperfect understanding makes him all the more dependent on the society to which he belongs. The analysis that has led to the concept of reflexivity also throws some light on the relationship between the individual and society. It is a mistake to think that there are two separate entities involved. The relationship is between a part and a whole. We have seen the cognitive difficulties that such a relationship gives rise to. Neither the individual nor society can be defined without reference to the other. Given the structure of our language, it is extremely difficult to recognize the contingent nature of the two entities, and as a matter of historical fact, most discourses on the subject have taken either the whole or the part as their starting point. The choice of the starting point tends to infuse the rest of the discussion with a bias. The famous speech of Agrippa, in which he compares society with an organism, epitomizes one extreme, and Rousseau's social contract the other. In order to avoid the bias inherent in these extremes, new categories of speech need to be established. An appropriate language is beginning to emerge in the context of computer science and systems analysis, but it will take time to permeate general discourse. Even if we learn to think in terms of reflexive and recursive relations, we are confronted with a substantive choice. Should society take a predetermined shape, or should its members be allowed to determine the form of society in which they live? The former kind of society has been described by Karl Popper as closed, the latter as open. I have just come back from China, where the issue is of vital significance. The country has passed through a horrendous period during which the collective terrorized the individual on a massive scale. It is now run by a group of people who have been on the receiving end of the terror. These people have ample reason to be passionately devoted to the cause of individual freedom. But they are up against a long tradition of feudalism, an all-pervasive bureaucracy, and the constraints of Marxist ideology. I was surprised to find an avid interest in the concept of reflexivity. As I have noted in the book, reflexivity could also be described as a kind of dialectics, but I have eschewed using the word because of the heavy intellectual baggage it carries. It is exactly these connotations that make the concept so fascinating for the Chinese, because it allows them to modify Marxist ideology without breaking with it. Hegel propounded a dialectic of ideas. Marx turned the idea on its head and espoused dialectic materialism. Now there is a new dialectic that connects the participants' thinking with the events in which they participate. That is, it operates between ideas and material conditions. If Hegel's concept was the thesis and Marxism the antithesis, reflexivity is the synthesis. But there is a fundamental difference between Marxism and the new dialectic. Marx labored under the misapprehension that, in order to be scientific, a theory has to determine the future course of history. The new dialectic is emphatically not deterministic. Since the shape of society cannot be scientifically determined, it must be left to the participants to decide their own form of organization. Since no participant has a monopoly on truth, the best arrangement allows for a critical process in which conflicting views can be freely debated and eventually tested against reality. Democratic elections provide such a forum in politics, and the market mechanism provides one in economics. Neither markets nor elections constitute an objective criterion, only an expression of the prevailing bias. But that is the best available in an imperfect world. Thus, the concept of reflexivity leads directly to the concept of an open society, hence its charm in contemporary China. As far as I am concerned, it completes what Hofstadter would have called a recursive loop between my concept of reflexivity, my interest in financial markets, and my devotion to the ideal of an open society. This is Grover Gardner for Wiley Audio. Thank you for listening. This audiobook is a co-production of Fenton Overseas and Audio Scholar. It is based upon the book entitled The Alchemy of Finance, written by George Soros. It is copyrighted in 1987 and 1994 in the name of George Soros, and is available in print form from the publisher, John Wiley & Sons, Incorporated.